Thanks so much for stopping by today for another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. Luann Crane here, along with Ryan Dobson. And our host, as always, is psychologist and best-selling author Dr. James Dobson. And yet, Ryan, he is in California right now preparing for his second installment of the Building a Family Legacy filming event this weekend.
Luann, we had such a great time with our friends last weekend who came to hear new insights on the family from my dad. And we are excited and ready for more this Friday and Saturday night.
And there might just still be a few seats left for those of you in the San Diego area who can make it over to Skyline Church this Friday or Saturday night. Very quickly, you can register online at drjamesdobson.org for this free taped event.
Well, Luann, although my dad is busy sequestered making some last-minute adjustments to his presentations, we still have a really good program today. Mm-hmm. My dad had a conversation with his great friend, Dr. Arch Hart, on hidden addictions. Luann, we live in a culture that in many, many ways celebrates excess.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to have the biggest house on the block, and there's so much with keeping up with the Joneses going on.
Well, Ryan, I would even go so far as to say that lavishness and that excess you just described have really become a part of American culture in particular. It is a shame, and as Christians especially, we should be seeking balance in all areas of our lives. Yeah. Unfortunately, if we don't maintain that balance, we can even see addictions and compulsions develop in our lives. Avoiding that serious problem is our topic for today, as your dad sat down with author and Fuller Theological Seminary professor, Dr. Arch Hart.
Well, the interview we're about to hear was based on his book, Healing Life's Hidden Addictions, Overcoming the Closet Compulsions That Waste Your Time and Control Your Life. Although this book is out of print on Amazon and all kinds of online retailers, you can still find copies of this really great book.
Because the subject matter is so relevant to many, many people, Ryan. So with that, let's pick up the discussion between our host, Dr. James Dobson, and his guest, Dr. Hart, as they begin their time together touching on stress and adrenaline addiction.
You know, the last time you were here, Arch, we had such an interesting conversation on adrenaline and stress, dealing with your book by that name. Was that the precise title?
That's it, yes.
Adrenaline and Stress. That's an excellent book. We're going to talk about it today, but I have to tell you, having had a heart attack since that interview with you, I've done some thinking about the things that you've said. You honestly believe that the adrenaline high that we get in the routine activities of our day is related, in some cases, to heart disease.
Absolutely. That what I call adrenaline addiction, which is, and I must confess that I'm a bit of a culprit myself in this regard, but that adrenaline high, that excitement, that challenge, that's the stuff of which stress is really made, the damaging stress.
It's really interesting because I love my work. I don't bite my nails. I don't have trouble sleeping at nights. I don't go home exhausted and depressed at night, all those sort of things. But your view is that I could still be under stress and love every minute of it.
Yes, because what you've just described a moment ago is what I call anxiety. And you are a low anxiety person.
Yeah.
But we confuse anxiety and stress. And I think stress can only be measured in terms of the biochemical effects it has, the corticosteroids, those group of hormones that are designed for the emergency response. And it's those hormones that produces the elevated cholesterol.
So adrenaline called upon at times when you really shouldn't be in need of what's called a flight or fight mechanism that jacks you up and calls on more energy.
Yes.
That relates to higher levels of cholesterol.
Absolutely. Yes. That's absolutely right.
But you'd be better off if you didn't.
I need to learn how to manage that. And that was the whole point of my adrenaline and stress book. Stress management is adrenaline management. Now, you can manage it with medication, and thank God that we have that available to us. You know, I thank God every day for the discoveries of medical science. But then eventually I've got to come back to myself and act more responsibly and live a more balanced life and know when to quit and when to say no and when to say that's enough, and then to learn how to enjoy low arousal. Because we are rapidly learning.
You know, I have had unbelievable quantities of advice since I had the heart attack.
I can believe it.
Much of it nutritional in nature. And there really is some misinformation there because no one has said to me, or very few have said to me, what I know to be true and what I know you believe, that what you eat only affects a fairly small percentage of cholesterol levels, maybe 10,
12%. 11, 12% is the Framingham study's finding. That now, diet is important. If you load up on fats, you are going to elevate your cholesterol. But when you boil it down and when you even it out, the best you can hope to lower it is 11, 12%. Beyond that, there have got to be lifestyle changes. You have got to learn to tolerate lower levels of arousal. I mean, think of it just in terms of arousal. And you know, it's very much the topic we want to talk about today, because I think we are all adrenaline addicts. And I think that lies behind a lot of the stress disease of today. And when you can't cope, when you feel helpless, when you feel out of control, then your stress levels will go up.
Well, we're going to talk about another source of stress today. Your book, Healing Life's Hidden Addictions, Overcoming the Closet Compulsions That Waste Your Time and Control Your Life. What do you mean by hidden addictions?
I use
how
the term,
is it that we don't know that they're there, if they're there?
I use the term hidden with three different meanings. Hidden in the sense that the sorts of behaviors we're talking about here are not taking in substances, but behaviors are socially sanctioned behaviors. Secondly, it's hidden in the sense that the person who has this sort of addiction doesn't know they've got it. But the third sense is the most important of all, I think, and that is that I am convinced from my research that many of these behaviors that are addicting may in fact have underlying biochemical mechanisms that provide the addiction, such as the adrenaline high that drives the workaholic, or the thrill seeker, or the tranquilizing effects of the body when you sit and watch the boob tube too long. And we have evidence now that there are powerful internal biochemical mechanisms at work that may go along with some of these behaviors and that could explain these so-called hidden addictions.
Let's get some definitions straight, okay? Describe in the context that you're writing about here the difference between an addiction and an urge or a compulsion. Mm-hmm. Or a strong desire.
Or a craving.
Yeah,
a craving of some sort. And let me hasten to add that I think we are over-diagnosing addictions today. I think there's a sort of a faddish feel about addictions. And to be an addict to something means you're a slave to it. That's really what the word means. It means that you can no longer control it. You have no choice over it. The television addict says, I'm going to sit down for half an hour and watch television, and 5 hours later is dead asleep because it cannot move away from that television set. In the long run, though, the addiction has to be damaging to be a true addiction. No matter how often you do something, if the long-term consequence of that is not damaging, we can hardly talk of it as an addiction.
Yeah, sexual behavior between a husband and wife is something that they are urged
pleasurable,
to do and like to do and do regularly,
and do regularly.
We would hope, and yet it's not,
it's
damaging,
not damaging,
so it's not addictive.
No, and it can only be an addiction if in the long term it's damaging. But I think there's one other aspect of what makes for an addiction, and that is, as with the substance addictions, Jim, it's an addiction when what you are doing or eating or drinking is anesthetizing your emotions, when it is a form of escape from the reality of life, where you cannot face your anxieties, your tensions, whatever it is that is to be dealt with. It's a form of escape, a form of emotional anesthesia, so to speak.
All right, let me press you just a little further on this definition thing. There have been times in my life when I've been 15, 20 pounds overweight. Mm-hmm. I'm big, I'm 6'2", and so I don't show it a whole lot, but there are times when I've been up. I'm not there now, as you can see. I got that way, I believe, because I like to eat.
Yes, but to enjoy food and even to eat to excess doesn't make that an addiction. Take workaholism, for example. The difference between the work enthusiast and the workaholic. They may not be in terms of the quantity of work they do, but the work enthusiast is not using the work as a form of escape from their feelings, from their emotions, from the reality of their life.
How can you tell? How do you know yourself? You say it's hidden from yourself.
It's hidden from yourself, but it is not hidden from others. And some of us may need to listen to a son or a daughter or a wife or a husband say to us, honey, you know, when you come home from work and you switch off and you will not engage your children in issues that need to be talked about, or you will not deal with your son's problem, or on and on and on, when you are using it as a form of escape to get out of or run away from your responsibilities, then it is no different to taking cocaine or drinking alcohol to excess.
Give me some other examples of hidden addictions. Mm-hmm. You mentioned workaholism. You mentioned eating as a hidden addiction. Yeah. Are there others?
Well, perhaps we could also think of the addictions, these hidden addictions, as falling into the same categories as the substance addictions. They are behaviors that stimulate, just as we have substances that are stimulants, and they are behaviors that tranquilize or are depressants, as in the substance. So that there's a very close parallel between what is substance addicting and what is behavior addicting. These stimulating behaviors are people who thrill-seeking. They are people who are addicted to thrills and excitements. And they do risky things, and they walk on the edge of parapets, and they're always looking for the thrill of some risky excitement.
Bungee cord jumping.
Bungee cord, exactly. Now, come on. I believe
you got
those
to be
people
a little
are going
to
be
dumb
well,
to do that. I mean,
but that becomes an addiction. You see, you want that, and now the other interesting thing is that there's a crossover effect from the substance addictions to these behavior addictions. It is now very widely believed that if you are addicted to a stimulating substance, you are also addicted to stimulating behaviors.
Does it work the other way? If you are addicted to a stimulating behavior, are you more likely to become addicted if exposed to substances?
Yes, you easily addict to a stimulating substance. And not only that, but to understand that one becomes addicted to stimulant, whether it's behavior or substances, is important, because long after the biological dependence on a substance for someone, say, who's been taking a stimulant, has passed away, they find that these people re-addict very rapidly. And often it's because they maintain the addiction to the stimulant substance by maintaining stimulating behaviors. So that if you are using a stimulant substance, even that is more socially acceptable as a stimulant, you are maintaining the addiction to the stimulant.
So in essence, if you got a problem in one of those areas, you better be careful, because you are a right candidate for addiction in the other.
That's right. That's my point. Now, the same is true for tranquilizing behaviors. Now, an example of stimulant behaviors would be thrill-seeking. I think workaholism and the true addiction form of it. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are work enthusiasts. I would not like to burden them with the guilt of feeling like they are an addict of some sort. You know, we all work hard, and that's what life is about. But there are some people who just go too far, and they are addicted. The adrenaline has got to be high. They can't stop doing it or working.
Because the first 3 days of a vacation, they lose their mind.
I was speaking to a pastor yesterday who is more my experience, that it takes me 10 days before I come
That's
off
bad news.
My adrenaline high. And you go through all the withdrawal symptoms. Yeah. You know, the restlessness, the fidgetiness, pacing up and down, turning the television set on, putting it off again. And 10 days it takes me. And he was saying that's exactly how long it takes him. So if you have a two-week vacation, you've got about 2 days, 3 days.
you're referring to yourself, too.
I am.
You have takes that long to come
it
down.
It does. When I'm not watching it, you see. Yeah. Now, I'm much more careful these days. I manage it very, very carefully, and that is I build in what I call Sabbaths all the time. I take little breaks. I know how to quit. I know how to get away from the pressures. But the tranquilizing behaviors now, for example, there are a whole group of behaviors that parallel the tranquilizing drugs. Television watching is the one most recently that we've got evidence of, that sitting and watching a television for several hours has a profound tranquilizing effect. And you can measure it on the body's changes in the chemistry and the physiology of the body, so that it is a powerful tranquilizing mechanism that comes out of that activity.
Well, now, is there a contradiction there, Arch, because you're recommending that people gear down?
Yes.
So why would you not want them to use this tranquilizing effect to gear down?
Good point. I think a tranquilizer in terms of behaviors is good for you, provided it doesn't cross one of the other criterion by which we judge whether something is addicting or not. Namely, it's a form
harmful.
Of escape. I don't want to, honey, get those kids off my back. I don't want to face the realities of my life. I'm going to sit and watch this television set. That's no different to a husband who says, get those kids off my back. I'm going to drink my beer, my liquor. You see, it's the same mechanism. But if you're fulfilling your responsibilities and if you are in control of the behavior, not it in control of you, then it's not an addiction. Another interesting tranquilizer comes from excessive exercise. Mm. We all know people who run and run and run and run a trillion miles to finally get to the place where there is this massive release of endorphins, these hormones in the brain that we've learned a lot about in recent years.
Arch, that's a dirty lie. I have been looking for that all my life.
You've never
I get
found
out
it
and
yet.
I run, and the only thing I think about is stopping.
but there is this massive release of endorphin, you see, that has a tranquilizing effect. And there are joggers out there, bless their souls, you know, who are running for that high. Now, I think exercise is important. But it has to be under control. It has to be not in excess or so excessive that it takes you out of your life.
Paul said we should have moderation in
all things.
Boy, the wisdom of the Scriptures comes through.
The Scripture is wisdom. But you see, it's hidden to us often when we, our whole work ethic, our whole culture is built on this supercharged dream. And many of us are living supercharged lives, supersonic lives, and hidden in that lifestyle is the risk of so much of this addictive mechanism. And this gets back again to underlying all these hidden addictions and the shoppers, and we'll get into compulsions and so forth in a moment. But in every one instance when someone is addicted to something like this, they are not able to face their emotions, their feelings directly. They're looking for an anesthetic of some sort. Mm. And that anesthetic comes either from stimulating behaviors or from tranquilizing behaviors. Those are the two main mechanisms.
How would you break out cause and effect here, Arch? Let's suppose an individual comes through childhood with great needs. Parents are not what they should be to that son or daughter. Uh-huh. Comes into adolescence rejected by his or her peers, doesn't get invited to the school functions, never has a date, feels ugly, unacceptable. Comes into the adult years, the person finds a profession that they can do, and not only do, but do well. The world needs their services, and they go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The addiction is set up, in that case, by the psychological
needs. The needs, the unmet needs that they carry over into adulthood.
All right. How about the biochemical frame of reference? A person inherits from the father, this vulnerability. Can you break out the biochemistry versus the psychological aspects of this?
But I don't think that having a vulnerability, say, built into your genes, into your body, necessarily creates the addiction. It just so happens that this inability to metabolize alcohol, that when you do take it to excess, that it's going to have a more powerful effect upon you. But the psychological need really has to be understood as the primary mechanism upon which these addictions are built. And there's just happens chance, really, whether you're going to be an alcoholic or a workaholic. Depends on certain weaknesses in your system.
We're going to talk about this next time again, but we have a couple of minutes left now. Just assure us that the psychological frame of reference and the anatomy and physiology are not destiny. Your subtitle here says overcoming the closet compulsions that waste your time and control your life.
Is
it possible to deal with this?
Absolutely. And if we were total victims of our bodies and our minds, there'd be no free will, there'd be no free choice. But I don't think that's true. I think that we are responsible for our choices, our decisions. We are responsible for the way we manage our bodies, manage our minds, just as we are responsible for the spiritual aspects of our being. And for many of us, we just need to increase our awareness of what we're doing. All I needed was the awareness that my exciting desire, my need for excitement was causing me problems.
And you still allow yourself to get excited.
I do, but I balance it. You see, the key word here is balance, and that one has to learn to balance one's life. I cannot use exciting behavior to avoid the responsibilities of life.
You still sleep 9 hours a night?
I sleep 9 hours. Jim, I'm a strong advocate of that, and I manage to do it. I really do.
And your workload, you can handle that during the day without feeling yourself sliding.
It's the other way around. Unless I get a good night's sleep, I cannot complete my work because it's an issue of efficiency. I think for me, I am far more efficient when my mind is rested and crisp and clear. I don't have to undo things as often. For me, it is a very, very important preparation for a balanced life.
You're not just talking about obsessive compulsive people, which
no.
I want to deal with in the next program, or those who are anxiety neurotics or have some particular emotional disorder. This is the North American lifestyle, isn't it?
Absolutely. This is the commoner's Bible for managing your life. We are dealing here with what affects every single one of us. As parents, I'm concerned at the way in which we are setting up our children.
Describe what obsessive compulsive behavior is. Give us some examples.
Well, obsessive compulsive behavior, in the strict clinical sense, is different from an addiction in that obsessions compulsions have to do with pain, whereas addictions have to do with pleasure. Now, the pleasure of addictions may have to do with stimulants or tranquilizers. But obsessive-compulsive behaviors are driven by pain, Jim. Let me illustrate. I believe there are people who shop excessively who are compulsive shoppers, and there are people who shop excessively because they are addicted to shopping. And the dynamics are different for those two mechanisms. In the addiction to shopping, the person uses the shopping as a lift to give them an oomph, to give them some stimulating behavior. Maybe they are in a boring relationship, or they have so many problems that they feel overwhelmed. They don't know how to deal with them. So they hit the shop. They take their money and they go and buy whatever they can to get an excessive lift coming out of that. Someone told me just a few days ago that she went and spent $3,000 that she doesn't have recently because she was so sick and tired of all her family problems. Everybody's getting on her back. It was the only way she could cope with that. It gives her pleasure. But there's a compulsive shopper, and the compulsion is different. For compulsions, strictly speaking, we're talking about pain. Here is a person who can't resist, who, unless they buy something, tension rises, anxiety increases. They've got to give expression to it. And so most of the obsession and compulsion behaviors have to do with relieving pain in some way. And so by engaging in the behavior, they relieve the pain.
Now, when obsessive compulsive behavior is at its most extreme, it absolutely dominates life, doesn't it?
It does. It controls everything. It shapes the way you think. That's why compulsions and obsessions go together, because you may be engaging in behavior that's compulsive, but you also have all these thoughts that are obsessing. So you lie awake all night and you can't think about anything else.
Well, this is another book that you've written, Arch, that has great practical application. There's an awful lot there that all of us can apply. Self-hatred, worry, entertainment, food, sex, shopping, codependency. Wow, we need to talk about that one. Control, exercise, work, and other addictions. There's a lot for us to talk about, and even if we do give the next broadcast to it, we're not going to cover it all. Arch, thanks for being here. We'll
Good to be
it
with
up,
you, Joe.
Next time.
Thank you.
Well, we hope this Family Talk discussion with special guest Dr. Arch Hart has been eye-opening for you, especially those of you who are struggling with addictions or compulsions. We want you to know there is help available for you.
And if you're ready to make that change and want to connect with those resources, call us here at Family Talk. We're available 24 hours a day. If you are in the grips of an addiction and need professional help, we can connect you with a Christian counselor. Our phone number is 877-732-6825.
And of course, you can also find that referral online at drjamesdobson.org. Also there, we can offer you some of Dr. Hart's books, like Adrenaline and Stress, which was discussed today. His other book on addictions is out of print, but certainly we can direct you to some places where you could find copies online.
And if you're listening today and are not struggling with an addiction, but you'd like to help Family Talk continue to reach out to hurting families, consider a donation to our work. You can find the Donate tab online at drjamesdobson.org, or one last time, our number is 877-732-6825.
And when you call, please do let us know how you hear Family Talk, whether it's the call letters of your favorite Christian radio station, or if you've recently begun listening to us on XM Satellite Radio. We're now heard there, Ryan, on America's Talk, Channel 166, at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific.
And before we go, don't forget, you can still register for the Building a Family Legacy event at Skyline Church in San Diego this weekend. We'd love to see you there. To register, go to drjamesdobson.org.
Thanks so much for spending this time with us today, and we hope to see you tomorrow for more with Dr. Arch Hart right here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.